Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 371, I chat with journalists Mike Heiss, Mark Henninger, and Tom Norton about what we all saw and heard at Cedia 2017. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded September 14th, 2017, episode 371, Cedia 2017 Roundup. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek and editor of AVSForum.com. This week, I have a whole raft of guest geeks joining me. First up is Mike Heiss, industry consultant and a jolly good Cedia fellow. Hey, Mike, welcome back.
Hi there. Thanks for having me back, Scott. It's always a pleasure.
Always great to have you here. Next up, Mark Henninger, senior editor at AVS Forum and my cohort in crime. Hey, Mark, glad to have you with us.
Glad to be here, Scott. Hi.
And finally, Tom Norton, senior editor at Sound and Vision. Tom, always great to have you here, too. Good to have you.
How you doing?
Good, thanks. Good to be here. Yeah. Those of you who are watching live at live.twit.tv can join the chat room there or at irc.twit.tv, and you can post questions as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. It always helps if you put my screen name in your message, anywhere in your message, because then it shows up in a different color. And my screen name is my name, Scott Wilkinson. No dots or dashes or spaces or anything like that. So what we're all here to talk about today is the Cedia Expo, or as I believe it was called this year, Cedia Exponential. Cedia, of course, stands for Consumer Electronics Design and Installation Association. So I'm very happy that they came up with an acronym that you can say a lot easier than that. This is a trade show every year that it moves around the country. This year it was in San Diego, and I was really happy about that because it's only a two-hour drive for me. And, Mike, I think you took the train down from L.A., right?
Yes, I did, but the train had, believe it or not, a flat tire going up, and it was only 5 hours late.
Oh, man, how can a train have a flat tire? I don't get that.
One of the wheels was out of spec.
Wow. Well, I'm sorry to hear that. I just drove down. Tom and Mark, you guys had to fly out.
I flew in from Florida.
From Florida. Now, Tom, just so we make sure, everything's okay at your house in Florida?
Oh, yeah. As far as I know, there wasn't much more than about maybe 25-mile-an-hour winds and a little rain. There wasn't hardly anything where I was.
Yeah, you're way up in the panhandle, so you were kind of out of the line of direct decimation. But we're very glad you did okay. And some of our friends who would have been at Cedia weren't because they live in Florida and they had to make sure that their property was okay. And if, as far as we know, everybody's okay that we know, right?
A lot of people left early.
A lot of people left the show early. Joel, in particular, Joel Silver, who's been on the show a number of times, left early to make sure he could get back before the airport were all closed. I think Tommy told me he survived okay.
Yeah, he did. I mean, I wound up having to stay an extra day because they closed some airports around here as an extra precaution, but got back okay on Monday night instead of Sunday.
Yeah.
And, I talked to Joel, and he was fine.
Oh, good. I'm so glad to hear that. Our hearts go out, of course, to everybody who suffered in that horrible storm. In any event, now we're back from Cedia, and I heard a number of people sort of say, there's not that much here. I couldn't disagree more. I thought there was a ton of cool stuff, which we're going to talk about today. And let's start with video. And I think, for me, the big video story, one of the big video stories, was the three Sony projectors that they introduced at the show. Tom, you agree?
Absolutely. Yep. They've got a $5,000 model, an $8,000 model, and the big one is a $25,000 model. And they've kept some of the old. Yeah, they've kept some of the older ones in the line. But if I were shopping for a Sony projector, I'd go for one of the new ones.
4K for 5K.
This was this was all over the show.
Yep. 4K for 5K.
Now, to be very specific, the signage at the show said 4K for under 5K. But how much under?
A penny.
One penny. $49.99.
Phil Jones from Sony was very diplomatic in his presentations, but I think that was a clear shot across the bow for Epson and some of the others.
And JVC.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, their
$25,000 laser projector is clearly a shot across the JVC's bow for their JVC's $35,000 laser projector.
Exactly.
But the 4K for 5K was a shot across the bow of 4K for 2.5K.
Yep. Yes. Now, we should make sure everybody understands what we're talking about here. That the Epson projectors, what they call 4K, and the JVCs, except for the really big gun, the $35,000 job, they all are what we call 4K, F-A-U-X-K, because their imaging panels in those projectors are actually 1080p, and they do what I call pixel wiggling. They call pixel shifting, which they take each pixel and wiggle it back and forth diagonally, double the number of pixels on the screen. That's still only 4 million pixels on the screen instead of 8, which true UHD would be, but it is higher resolution than, you know, your standard 1080p. But these Sony projectors are true 4K. They're even real 4K. They're 4096 by 2160. So that's cinematic 4K. See, we don't even need to couch them in, well, it's UHD and not really 4K or whatever. They're true 4K. So, and for $5,000, that's really amazing.
Yeah. And they looked really good.
One thing that's important to point out is the $5,000 projector leaves out a couple or two or three of the features that the $8,000 projector has. Yeah. It has no dynamic iris, so its potential for getting good blacks is probably okay, but not the same as having the iris. And it doesn't have lens memories. And I'm not sure, but it might not even have motorized lens. But that might be motorized.
It does.
But there's no memories.
No, it does have motorized lens. I asked that.
Yeah, but
so
there's no
memories
for it.
That's a good thing. But no memories.
There's no memories. No memories for it.
Right.
And there may be one or two other things, but those are the biggies that I noticed.
We have a picture of the Sony projectors. If you can find them and put it up there, we'll just see what's going on. And while he's looking for that, Mark, what was your impression of the Sony projectors?
Well, I talked to Phil Jones about them, and in particular because I have a VW365ES in my home theater right now, about what the 285 was compared to that. And he said it's a direct upgrade. You're actually going to get a better lens. It still, like the 365, lacks the lens memory, which is a hassle. Absolutely is a hassle. But, you know, the new price point basically means that you're, at least per Sony, you're getting a projector that should put even more detail on screen for less money. And then if you are willing to buy the new 385ES, then of course, you get upgraded and get the lens memories and a bit more brightness and some other features. But that $5,000 price point can satisfy many use scenarios that I can think of.
Burke, that picture's called Sony Projectors. I tried to make the names as easy as possible and short as possible, because I know you can only see a certain number of them in the TriCaster, a certain number of characters. There it is.
Yeah.
So,
To expound on one thing, the thing that I'm really excited about is that these projectors, even at the base level, can handle above 24p, which the 365ES with HDR, 24p was the limit. So now all of these at least can handle streaming HDR. If you're using an external, you know, box, those don't supply you with 24p native. So there's a lot more compatibility with HDR across this entire line.
Very good point.
It looks like some company called AVS Form or whatever they are that gave some awards to the Sony projector.
Who are those guys?
Well, now we will say that for the first time in quite a while, AVS Forum gave Best of CD awards to certain products. We actually gave 12 awards out, or 12 companies. And what you see there are the awards on all three projectors. And we gave an award basically to all three projectors because they represent something pretty special, especially the low-end one, as we've been talking about, the $5,000 one. which really bests most other $5,000 4K, UHD, 4K, whatever you want to call them, projectors. It really does. And we're going to take a look at some other examples of projectors that were at the show that cost quite a bit more and offer quite a bit less. So we have to give Sony some serious kudos.
One of the things that somebody's mentioned HDR that none of the projectors had from any of the brands was Dolby Vision.
Correct. And that we're not going to see that anytime soon on any projector. Dolby Vision is kind of a special case. It's implemented in their commercial cinema projectors, but the brightness that you get off of a screen from a home projector depends on so many factors, including screen size, light output from the projector, that sort of thing, that I don't think it's practical to implement Dolby Vision on any projector at this point. Now, I will say the Sony projectors, they don't implement Dolby Vision, but they do implement HLG, Hybrid Log Gamma, which is the format of high dynamic range that is most likely to be used in live broadcast TV. So that's pretty cool. Somebody had something to say there. I interrupted somebody. If not, then we'll keep going on. I Am Special is asking, do you need special players to complement these new projectors? The answer is no. In fact, Tom, I think you mentioned it, right? Or might have been Mark, that they've increased the HDMI data bandwidth. Mark, okay, thank you. They've increased the HDMI data bandwidth to – now, this was weird. This is weird. Not to 18 gigabits per second, which I would have expected, but to 13.5 gigabits per second, which will allow – right? It's a little bit lower.
The top one, the laser one, is 18.
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
Correct. The 885 is 18 gigabits, but the 285 and the 385 are 13.5 gigabits. And I asked them, why did they do that? And they said, well, to save some cost. Come on. You know, how much more? As some people have pointed out, Mark, I think you've seen these comments on AVS Forum as well. You know, there are $100 products. The Chromecast has Dolby Vision in it. You know, that's a $70 product. So how much could it cost to implement that to 18? I'm sorry, not Dolby Vision, 18 gigabits.
18 gigabits, yeah.
So how can it be that expensive? I don't get that. But they did do it because, as Tom said, that lets you stream, or Mark, you said it, sorry, more than 24 frames per second. You can go up to 60 frames per second. With HDR and it works. And it was interesting in the demo that we saw, they compared the Sony. Mike, did you see this demo? Did you go into the
yes, that was Sony the one where Phil put the chart up of all the data rates and some of the projectors that they were feeding sort of went blank at the higher data rates. And he was claiming 17.8 for some of the content, and that's really kind of over the speed limit, because when you add up the headroom, you can't get to 17.8.
Right, exactly. Tom, you must have seen that demo as well, right?
I think I saw it at a different time. I saw it earlier in the day at 11 o'clock. I didn't see Mike there. He might have gone on a later one. Yeah.
Well, that was once or twice each day, yeah.
It was a very impressive comparison where they showed the Sony laser against the JVC laser. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, it was hard to choose which one was better.
Yeah.
they're both terrific.
They're both terrific. Both of them are true 4K, 4096 by 2160, both with laser light engines, both with 18 gigabit HDMI, but the JVC is 10 grand more.
Yeah, the JVC claims a higher lumens, but as they pointed out, and I agree with them, you really can't compare lumen ratings between manufacturers. Because they all have their own way of measuring it.
Precisely right. Exactly right. We should also mention JVC, because JVC, they introduced new projectors at CES last January. And I thought, okay, well, that's their projectors for 2017. Well, nope. yes and no, because they introduced yet new ones at CEDIA. Yeah. with lower prices, which I thought was very interesting. They had the... X590 for $4,000. That's the same as the entry level from the last one. The X790, there's the X990, which is $8,000, $2,000 less than its counterpart, than its previous generation version. That we're showing, that photo is with the ceiling mount on it. That's all they had on static display. And the 790 is $6,000, the middle one, $1,000 less than the previous generation. I thought those, they were showing the X990 in a darked out room with HDR content. I thought it looked pretty good. although I learned that they had, they've implemented a new thing now that basically you can choose. Do you want the color filter in the light path or not? And what the color filter does is it gives you wide color gamut. So it gives you what's called P3 color, but it also reduces the peak brightness. And so would you rather have peak brightness and 709 color, which is not what we would consider wide color gamut? Or would you rather have reduced brightness and a wider color gamut? You get your choice. They were showing it without. And without wide color gamut, without the filter in it, so that you had a better HDR picture. But I thought it looked pretty darn good, Tom.
Oh, and they showed that closing scene from the Great Wall with all that color inside the tower.
Yeah,
it certainly looked intense enough to me, color wise.
Yeah, it did to me too. Mark, did you see it?
No, I was not that. Sorry.
Yeah, you were focused more on audio, I know, because you and I had to cover the show for AVS Forum, and you saw some demos, I'm sure. Mike, did you see the JVCs?
Yes, I did, and maybe it's because I had a little Phil Jones, and for those he's been on the show, hasn't he?
He has, yes.
For those who don't know Phil Jones, he's the trainer extraordinaire for Sony, and he looks like the Donald Osborne guy on Jay Leno's Garage, which I think about all the time, but he's a really good sport. But I had a little Phil Jones on my shoulder, and when I went to the JVC booth, it looked good. I just, without the having a side by side, I think the Sony's looked better.
Mm-hmm. Mark, I'm sorry I interrupted you. You had something else to say?
Oh yeah, that was exactly what you were saying. Just that I didn't have a chance to see all the projection demos.
Right, because you were focused on audio, which we'll get to here shortly.
I was a little disappointed in the half of the JVC demo of their 990, and that I think I talked to you about this earlier, Scott. That the I thought they were pushing the HDR a little too hard. Maybe that's because they used what you said. They went for a higher dynamic range rather than the color.
Right,
and there were some highlights that just didn't look natural to me, and I've seen that scene on other displays, including some OLEDs, and they don't look like that. So,
interesting. Okay, well, generally speaking, though, we're talking about lower prices for better quality, better performance. Generally speaking, so that was really good news. Interestingly, there were a number of DLP projectors there. These, by the way, the Sonys and the JVCs all use a technology called DILA or LCOS, more to the point, a liquid crystal on silicon. JVC's version is called DILA. Sony's version is called SXRD. they all use three chips, one for red, one for green, one for blue. And the Epsons do that with LCD projection, with LCD panels. DLP projectors, except when you get into the extreme high end, and I'm talking extreme high end, they use a single chip, a single imaging chip, and what's called a color filter wheel that spins around. It's got segments of red, green, and blue, and maybe some other colors. And they put the red part of the image up, and then the green, then the blue, then maybe some of the other ones, and that forms the entire color image. And even the expensive ones from Digital Projection and Barco, I thought looked pretty bad myself. I did not see any DLP projector there that I really liked. Tom, I think you'd probably agree with that, right?
I would say primarily in the area of the contrast and black level, they were just kind of
Exactly. I saw, for example, in the slightly lower priced range, the Optima UHZ65, which we do have a picture of, and again I tried to name it that so that it would be easy to find, And if that's not there, then the – oh, it isn't there. The BenQ then is the other one that does have a picture. Mark, I believe, took this – oh, no, Mike took this picture.
Yeah, I wasn't impressed with the BenQ. The Optima wasn't bad. The BenQ, not so much. But in a back room, I don't know if you got to see it, Scott, TI was showing a new version of the chips that's 0.44 inches. Easy for you to say. And
yeah, really.
It's coming out in products next year. And they weren't very good on motion content, but they showed some test patterns. And, you know, everybody's shooting at everybody else. And it really did look good.
Yeah. Now, we should say that the Texas Instruments chip that is in these 4K DLP projectors is also using pixel wiggling. But... Yep. They're starting with a total of 4 million pixels on the chip and then wiggling that up to 8 million. So they're closer to real UHD or 4K than Epson and JVC's 4K, as we call it.
Well, that's true of the chip that's out there currently, the 0.67
correct.
Chip or whatever.
Correct.
Now, the one Mike just mentioned, the point, I thought it was 0.47, maybe it's 0.44. The one that they showed as a prototype at the show is only a 2K chip.
They wiggle four times
instead of twice, and for each frame. It's a very fast chip, and they wiggle it four times, and they're doing the color wheel, so they're doing
red, green, and blue separately.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an awful lot of wiggling going on there, if you ask me.
Well, that's why
DLP is dead on AVS forum for anything except the budget sector. That's true.
Yeah.
There's nobody even talking about it.
TI is actually taking advantage of someone when they specified 4K, they said it has to show 8 million pixels on the screen per frame.
Yep.
It didn't say at the same time.
The TI people were really heavy on that 8 million per screen, and I picked up my notebook here, and you're right, Tom, it is 0.47, but they made a big deal, and they said 4 million pixels per mirror, and then they'd shift them, and that's how they get the 8 million on screen. But yeah, they were very big on pointing that out.
Yeah. Beatmaster is asking, what influence does the wiggling have on HDR? I'm not sure it does have much of an influence. That has more to do with, DLP technology in general doesn't really get down into the deep blacks as much as LCOS or LCD. I think it's a limitation of the technology, inherent limitation of the technology, rather than whether or not we're doing pixel wiggling or not. The other thing I wanted to say with respect to the BenQ is that they had two models there that you saw in the photo, the HT8050 and the HT9050. The 8050 lists for $8,000, and the 9050 is $9,500.
Wow.
It's like, what? What? I can't. And not only that, that's manual lens shift. Take one more look at that picture, and you'll see those little knobs on top of the projector. That's manual lens shift, whereas the Sony 285 at $5,000 gives you motorized lens shift.
Scott, I think that these, given BenQ and Optoma, these guys are really looking at the boardroom and, fixed installation kind of market. And, hey, let's sell them to the home theater guys as well. And the TI said the same thing. They sell bazillions of Road Warrior projectors. Mm-hmm. And that's really why I think you don't have the kind of features that the audience here would expect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there was actually another one of those 0.67 chip DLP projectors in the DARTS room, DARTS.
Oh, yeah.
That's a Phase Technology. That's their high-end speaker line. And the projector they were using was – I don't have the model number in front of me – was from SIM2.
It was a SIM2 Nero 4, I can tell you that.
Nero 4. And SIM2 was not at the show, which I found kind of surprising.
Yeah, I was too.
But that SIM2 projector using the 0.67 wiggle chip – $30,000.
Yeah.
I'm
and
not
it
sure
didn't
what they're
look
thinking.
Very good.
Yeah, no. I've not had good experiences with them, unfortunately, and I've calibrated a few Sim2s, and it's just the black levels kill it. It, I don't know when they got surpassed, but yeah. I mean, they don't have the rainbow effect. Give that to the triple, you know, chip.
This is a single advantage. Chip. This is a single chip.
Oh.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, so they all have,
No,
yeah, so they have rainbow. It did. What? I saw.
I don't mean to be rude, but it's a fact that AVS members have looked at those and inside buried inside some Sim2s are Optimas and BenQs, and it's just Italian glass on top of and a new light engine usually, but there's a lot going on in there that's just coming right out of those projectors we just talked about.
Yep, exactly right. Compter in the chat room is asking. Saying the 4K Sony projector for 5K is a deal. I agree. I think all of us would agree.
Such a deal.
And Jack is asking, would you recommend the Sony 4K for 5K for a normal home user? I say absolutely. For those who want a projection system as opposed to a flat panel. Now, you're not going to get nearly as much brightness. You're going to need to control the ambient light in that room much more or get an ambient light rejecting screen. And we're going to talk about screens in a minute. Projection is more limited generally. And we're going to talk about how to overcome that here just in 1 second. But before we do, I want to just quickly mention ultra short throw projectors, because there were a couple of those at the show that were pretty cool, too. Often referred to UST, ultra short throw, which means you put the projector basically a few inches from the wall. It shoots the light up onto a 100 or 120 inch screen on the wall or even onto the bare wall, which I don't recommend. But a lot of people say, oh, you can do that. And I go, yeah, you can, but I wouldn't. They're marketing this as kind of a flat panel substitute. The biggest news there was the Epson LS100, which we have a picture of, which it really breaks the price barrier for UST projectors. Sony has one for $50,000. Hisense had one at the show for $10,000, which includes a screen and a sound system. This Epson, which we're seeing here, which I gave a AVS Forum Best of Cedia 2017 award to, as you can see, lists for $3,000. So that's
however, it's got the Epson's 2K.
Correct, 1080p.
Yeah, 1080p. That's with true. The Hisense is 4K.
Correct.
Which is $10,000. Yeah, and the Sony actually has one for $25,000. We just reviewed it, and Al Griffin reviewed it in one of our recent issues.
The interesting thing is, all three of those that we've just mentioned are all illuminated with lasers. They're all even that inexpensive Sony.
that gets you instant on and off. I think we're talking about the lifestyle aspect of it. Does it behave like a TV? We were just talking, right. The instant on and off is a big requirement there.
Correct.
And also Vivitech also had a 2K short throw projector for somewhere under $4,000.
Sorry, who?
Vivitech.
Oh, Vivitech. And they were, yes. I believe they were at the show, weren't they?
They were. They had a room with about four, very confusing. They had like four projectors in the room, but one of them was a short throw.
Okay, very good.
And Hisense was there again, right, with their system they showed at CES?
They said this was an updated version of the one they showed at CES.
I can see one problem with the short throw projectors is they can compensate for the geometrical issue and focus issues because of the screen. It's hard to compensate for the brightness issues, the distance between the bottom of the screen and the top of the screen. I'm not sure. I don't have any experience with it. But I'm not whether that's completely cured.
I don't either. That might be a problem or it might not be. I was more concerned with whether or not those projectors are doing what we call keystoning.
Yeah.
Because you're shooting the image way at a steep, steep angle, and the image would naturally be not rectangular. And so you have to compensate for that. And if you do that with electronic scaling, then you damage the picture. Yeah. Emily the Strange is asking, is there a correlation between the higher definition, better quality projectors and the better features and lower bulb life? Well, lower bulb life has to do with whether or not it's a bulb or a laser. And a lot of people are going towards laser illumination because of that exact thing. They're rated at 20,000 hours. In fact, Digital Projection, a very high-end company that does only DLP, they told me one of their stories at Cedia was that they're not using bulbs anymore at all, just lasers. So for that reason alone.
One projector that we haven't mentioned important was the laser projector from Epson, which is not new. Okay, they've had for a couple of year or two the 10,500. Correct. They were showing it at the show, and it looked better to me than it has in the past.
Yeah, I agree.
They said that they have sometime in this year, I don't know exactly when, they've got an extensive firmware update to it that improved its performance. So take that for what it's worth. But
I saw it. Kevin Miller, who's been on the show, also a calibrator, very excellent calibrator, calibrated that projector, and I thought it looked fabulous. It really looked great. Yep. The one other thing I want to talk about, two other things actually, with regard to video before we move on to audio, is, as I mentioned earlier, projectors have a problem with brightness. They don't have nearly the brightness that a flat panel TV does. And so one of the solutions or one of the ways to combat that we've now seen at CES, and we saw several examples here at Cedia, are called LED video walls. Now, the one we saw at CES was the Sony Cletus crystal LED integrated system. Basically, what it is tiny little LEDs that form the picture directly. It's kind of like those signs you see in Vegas. You know, you drive around Vegas, you see these giant signs that are super bright. Those are LED video walls, to put a name on it. But of course, those are for outdoors. And so the distance between the pixels can be very fairly wide. In the home, which I think we will see in a few years, we'll start seeing them become available. The pixels have to be much closer together. The best one I saw was from this company called Layard, which recently purchased Planar, which had several years ago purchased Runco. So it's like a big fish eating a littler fish and so on and so forth. we have a picture of the Layard TWA 0.9, which is a 0.9 millimeter pixel pitch. That was my pick for the best LED video wall at the show. That's LEYARD. This was an interesting, in the Layard booth, they had a comparison of pixel pitches at 1.8 millimeters, 1.5, 1.2, and 0.9. And you could see, you know, basically the closer together the pixels get, the less you see them, obviously, right? at a normal seating distance. However, the closer together they get, the more expensive they are, and also the less bright they are in the current technology. Digital Projection also had one called the Radiance LED, that's the Layard. There's the Layard. It was 162-inch image, and it had, I think, 500 nits of brightness. You're never going to get that from a projector, never, in a home theater. So I thought that was quite interesting. Digital Projection had one called the Radiance LED, that was at a 1.5 millimeter pixel pitch, a little bit bigger pixel pitch. And Mark, you said you sat and looked at it for a while, and you could see the pixels even at somewhat of a reasonable distance.
Experimenting with that, and I could see pixel structure barely, but definitely from where the couch was. So that would bother me a little bit. I'd have to be just a bit further back than how they had it set up for it to look seamless.
Right, but they were getting close to 1,000 nits out of that thing.
All right, sorry, so that's a trade-off.
There was another one. I don't know if you saw it when we were all running around. Sort of in the back of the hall was Barco, where they not only had the LED systems, but they were showing video art, which is big, which was another, I would say, a big trend. But it was something you saw in more than a few of the booths. And in fact, I'll jump the shark here and say, if you ask me what the best video program material I saw at the show was the video art stuff in the Barco booth on the LED displays. It was really, really good.
Yeah, yeah. The other one that I saw there at the show was from this company called Go Vision TV, which was a 2.6 millimeter pixel pitch. So it was pretty big and not really intended that much for indoor use. They were making more like outdoor stadium lighting, you know, outdoor stadium displays. So if you have a big football party at your house and you're outdoors by the pool, you could have one of these things and it would look like you're at a stadium.
And they'd be the first one to say that that's what it's for.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly so. okay. One other thing I want to quickly mention. Oh, a couple things. Samsung SpectraCal, auto calibration. That was pretty cool. Mark, you took a closer look at that, and you've actually used the auto calibration on more than one display. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, you know, the way they were discussing it there, and by the way, Samsung was also showing off those frame things. So art on displays was definitely a theme at that show.
Yes.
Those frame TVs. But what they were talking about advantages that I enjoyed, you know, when I used it in a review context, which is speed. It's tedious to go in and out of a menu to do a 10-point, much less a 20-point, you know, white balance, for example, or to do CMS adjustments. And you can let a computer perform that actual task automatically and still have manual control over the calibration, and the end result is a huge time saving. So, you know, SpectraCal was talking about that something could take an hour to 2 hours manually with a remote control gets reduced to a 10 to 15-minute system. The other thing they were talking about was consistency. It's the best calibrators are going to get the best result by executing some manual control over what they're doing, but the automated process can get you a very good calibration. It's consistent. So they're saying, you know, quite literally that, you know, an integrator who maybe isn't a calibration expert but has the gear and does calibrations as an add-on service, at this point, they'll be able to execute it very quickly and consistently, as opposed to maybe have it be something that makes their install drag on and they don't actually get the result they were wishing for. So those are good things for them. For me, the cool thing is direct display control. So you don't have to let it go automatically, but you don't have to go into the TV with the remote control either. You can do everything that you do as a calibrator manually, but much more efficiently. So that's a great thing. Wish it was on all their TVs. As it stands, it's on TVs that have a One Connect box that has a serial input. That's not just the QLEDs, but it's really any TV from Samsung that has those.
Right, which they told me was everything from the MU6300 on up through the MU series and the QLEDs. You can now apply this Samsung SpectraCal auto calibration.
So not to put a fine point on it, but Best Buy, which is probably like the biggest organization in the U.S. that sells calibrations and Samsung TVs, can now do a calibration quickly and in a uniform, reliable manner.
Mm-hmm. Okay, one last thing about video that I want to mention is fiber optic HDMI cables. I thought this was super cool. A company from Japan called Fiber, spelled F-I-B-B-R, had a tiny little booth, and they were showing an HDMI cable. Here's a picture. They were basically playing a 4K HDR video from that little box in the lower right, running it through a 10-meter long fiber optic cable. Basically, what it is it's got HDMI connectors on either end. In the HDMI connector is a tiny little bit of electronics that converts the electrical signal from HDMI to optical pulses, sends them down the optical cable, and then converts them to electrical at the other end. And they can go up to 200 meters. Here you can see they have they had it all coiled up. In addition, I have a close-up of the bend. They had this thing going through. They bent the cable. They basically folded it over in half, in a 180-degree turn. I believe it's called – there it is. I mean, look at that. That's a fiber optic cable that is just really folded in half, and there was no problem. The data got to the display and worked just fine. So I was quite amazed at that, and I actually gave them a Best of CD award too, because I thought that was just so cool. Don't be doing that with copper, or even other fiber optics. Can't bend that much. Now, and even more important, it conveys 18 gigabits per second, the fastest that HDMI can currently do, over 10 meters, 20 meters, 200 meters, and it's ISF certified, even better. They also showed a prototype of their Ultra HK. This is called Ultra Pro. The Ultra HK will have a bandwidth of 56 gigabits per second, which is more than the maximum of HDMI 2.1, which we don't even have yet. So they're really looking at the future. And I think their 8K version, their 56 gigabit version, will run up to 50 meters. But, I mean, geez, a regular HDMI cable, even for 4K HDR, if you run that more than a couple of meters, you're going to run into trouble. So this is a big deal that I think a lot of people are going to like. Now, it's expensive. 10-meter length, I think it sells on Amazon now. I think it's like $300. So it ain't cheap, but the other cool thing about it is that it gets its power. The little bit of electronics in the cable, in the connectors, get their power from the HDMI port. I saw one other example of a fiber optic HDMI cable at the show, but it needed a separate power connector to a USB port to get its power. So that was clunky, I thought.
Yeah, a company called Metra, they have a huge catalog here, but they also have some regular HDMI cables that they claim will go up to 8 meters, and they have some active HDMI cables, which do look like they have one USB connector to help power it, that they claim it'll do full 4K HDR up to 30 meters.
Okay. So, you know, with an active HDMI cable, copper cable, you can get longer distances.
Yeah. Yeah.
But this is without having to plug it into something else, which I thought was just very cool.
Yeah.
Okay, before we go any farther on this, I really wanted to switch to audio because there was quite a bit of audio news there as well at the show. Some processors and AVRs. Mark, why don't you start us off with that, because you were covering more audio than video.
Sure. Well, everybody's letting you stream your music by asking Alexa to do it for you. That was a clear, not just trend, just an overarching theme at the show. You know, there were releases from the big major companies. Your Polk, Deftek, Marantz. Marantz had a big SR8012 AVR there, so that's 11 amplified channels. And also, Denon Marantz announced that Oro 3D is now shipping with their AVRs unlocked, so it's no longer an add-on that costs people money. Maybe we'll give that format a chance to grow. But let me tell you what I think the biggest news there is. The biggest news, clearly verified by more than enough companies, even though there was no press release, is that 9.1.6 Dolby Atmos decoding is coming to DSP-based processors. And that's,
now, up till now, the limit has been what?
7.1.4 in the AVR world. The high-end AV processor DSP-based guys have been getting 9.1.4, and Trinov alone had created their own custom solution, not based on DSP, but rather on an Intel chip and an i7 that could, in fact, do 9.1.6. But they worked that out with Dolby. That's why you pay megabucks for Trinov. So, yeah, the news here would be that Dolby will soon release the code that will allow 16-channel processors and AV integrated units to do this 9.1.6. But yeah, for all practical purposes, 7.1.4 has been the ceiling for Dolby at home.
Mm-hmm. I've got to chime in there, and I have to be careful not to get on the wrong side of some NDAs. They are releasing the code, but it's not going to be an upgrade to existing products because it's going to require quite a bit more processing power. And there are three, as I hope some some of you know, there are three different DSP chips, and the DSP guys have to implement it, and that's not quite there yet, which is probably the best I can say.
Mm. Sure. But it's coming. Sure. So, it's coming.
Yeah, the main thing is that it's coming in terms of something that will be supported. When and how and so on and so forth is strictly fingers crossed. There is no press release. I'm not under NDAs. I'm just talking about what I sussed out through multiple conversations with the right people.
Right. I thought there were a couple of interesting AV processor introductions. What sort of introductions? The Emotiva RMC1 was finally demonstrated in public. It's been long awaited, right, Mark?
That's right. Maybe one of the most long and eagerly anticipated processors, because its price makes it very disruptive versus DataSat and Chernobyl would be the two that you'd name right away. Now, it's not going to be a 32-channel solution, which those other companies offer, but certainly Emotiva has stated that absolutely it has the DSP processing headroom to do 9.1.6, which literally Dan Loffman posted in ABS forum today. They expect by Christmas. So,
wow.
Hey,
I know it's going to be there.
I'm just telling you what that guy.
No. I know it's going to be there, and I believe what Dan is saying. I'm just going from the flip side. Is without the anything against Dan, I would question whether or not the code to do that will be done and certified for them to deliver it by Christmas. I'm sure they're going to deliver it. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. The question is when.
Mm. Yes, nobody really knows for sure. And I think there's just a lot of, like I said, finger crossing hopefulness that it will, so that at CES these companies can be showing that, because I think that's what they want to be showing. And if they don't have it by freaking Christmas, then it's not going to be CES, and then it's just the whole big miss. And I think that's why they're all hoping for that, and I'm sure they're pushing for it.
I can tell you, but I'd have to kill you, and then somebody would come and kill me.
Yes, yeah. Right. So let's not go into that. We have a picture of the Emotiva RMC1, I think, and just look for Emotiva, because I think it's the only picture that starts with that name. And we can see that is actually a thing.
Was it playing in their demo room? I saw it outside the booth. I didn't have time to go there.
The RMC1?
Yeah. Yes,
it was only capable of decoding Atmos in its engineering sample form at that show, and that's exactly what it was doing. It was powering an Atmos. Good. In theory, better, though. It wasn't running Dirac Live. It was really...
It's in the second batch.
It was just performing that task of decoding... Atmos and playing it back, through a more basic, Dirac could up it yet another notch, is what I would say. But it already sounded good. Just, it's...
There it is.
It's good enough to give an award to, but still more potential. That's what you can say about this device right here.
Okay.
Did Emotiva ever, I'm not sure how you pronounce that, did they ever fix their volume setting on their previous pre-pros had the XX.X digits, but it only had 1 dB steps. The point, the digit after the point did nothing. It was always zero.
I did not twirl the knob.
Should have. always want to twirl the knob.
one of the processors that I was most interested in, and Mark, I know you wrote a lot about it, was from Storm Audio, with I think the most clumsy model name I've ever seen. I.ISP3D.16.12. What?
That sounds like an image file name.
I know.
It does. It's, yeah.
Tell me what it was.
Yeah, 3D integrated immersive sound processor. That's what all that stands for. 16 process channels and 12 amplified. So this is really the most hardcore AVR that I have seen, because those 12 amplified channels are rated at 200 watts per channel concurrently. You will find most AVRs have a lower 2-channel concurrent, not 12-channel concurrent rating than that. So pretty cool thing. It replaces a rack of amps. But my favorite part which is when I first saw it before it was released as a product at CES, is the web interface for setting it up. It's really deep. You can go in there. You could set up. You could use it to create a pair of eight-way, just a two-channel system with eight-way speakers if you wanted to. You could basically go in and create any crossovers and EQ, and you can apply Direct Live to all of it in sort of a completely open, like I said, web-based thing. And you know, they're selling it to custom integrators. So, you know, what they were announcing at CEDIA is that web interface allows the integrator to configure the units remotely and monitor the units and bringing all that stuff into the table. But my personal experience with it and why I love it so much, it transformed my home theater. Same speakers I've been using before. Because of that extra power, there's no comparison to an AVR. There's much more power and therefore much more impact in the room. I watch a movie, I turn the volume up to reference, and it delivers what I would call the Cedia $100,000 demo room experience, which AVRs can't get me there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't even have that large a room. It's just that you run out of juice when you are doing a full immersive and you've got that many speakers. Even if you have an 11-amp AVR like the Marantz, you know, lovely, 140 watts per channel. But if you look at the little asterisk, it's for two channels driven. And we all know with those AVRs, if you try to drive all the channels, you're not going to get those big numbers. So anyway, that's why I love it. Because it's just one box that can give you that rack of awesome gear experience and also Direct Live. Another theme I saw definitely at the show was Direct Live showing up in more and more products. I met with the two guys who started the company and had really fought it. I didn't realize what a small, scrappy, you know, beginning they had. And so congratulations to them to get this far. And now their product seems to be appearing in, all kinds of different AVRs from Pioneer on up to the top, and that includes the Storm Audio. So I'm glad it's in there because it's great room correction.
We should say yes. We should make sure that everybody knows that this Direct Live is one of the several available room correction technologies that basically take care of automatically finding out where your speakers are, what the acoustic problems in the room are, and effectively improving that situation so that it sounds as good as possible.
Yeah, Mike's right. Lexicon, too, took on Direct Live and had new AVRs as well. There's plenty of AVR news at that show.
Yeah, there was plenty.
Yeah. One disappointment for me was that on the Marantz side, is if you're aware that their version of Odyssey, at least on their newer products, lets you set it up so that it can equalize just up to a specified frequency instead of equalizing the whole frequency range. It just goes up to, let's say, 200 or 300 hertz, where all your bass problems are in the room anyway.
Which is where most room problems are.
Right, and most of their new products let you do that, but not the 8802A, which is their most expensive pre-pro, cannot accept that feature. It cannot be upgraded to that feature because
it's
apparently
too old.
It's based on the 8801, which is, you know,
fairly old. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
They did announce the AV7704, which is, I guess, their latest model. Mark, right?
Right. So that'll support that, and that is an 11-channel processor. And I think that's what it is with any of these products is it depends on what the platform it's being built on is. And in this case, it's not 8,000 series, it's 7,000, but you're actually getting a feature leap forward. I like the app and Tom's right. That's kind of a crucial capability that had previously been something that was, I thought, you know, made Direct explicitly better than Odyssey, being able to create that limit to where, you know, the range that it applies to. So you can only do, as it were, the frequencies below your room's shorter point, and that's where the bass gets affected by the room itself and not by the speaker's native response. That's great feature for Odyssey, and plus the phone lets you store as many profiles as you want, so you can just upload and switch between or phone or tablet app, I should say. So another benefit is that you can have a whole bunch of calibrations just for yourself, sitting here, sitting there, covering the whole range, covering part of the range. If you're like me and you're a reviewer, you can get multiple different speakers profiled and be able to do switches. So it's great. And yeah, not having it would make me think twice about purchasing something, even if it was ostensibly the flagship.
I did ask about do they have a replacement for the 8802A, which is again the one that won't do Odyssey, only do it all the way. They said they implied it would be next spring, so it might be something we'll see at CES. But of course, I don't know. Marantz does CES, so they haven't in the last couple of years, so we'll find out. That doesn't
we'll
mean
find
they
out.
Introduce it. Yeah.
Right. Under the Sound United umbrella, though, you'd think maybe Unified. Yeah, one thing you noticed at Cedia was that the Unified booth. Those companies used to be spread out, and now it's you see DefTech, yeah. Polk, Marantz, and Denon, and under the same 5,000 square feet, I think they said. They had.
Yep. So it'd make more sense for them to go to CES than it did in the past.
Yeah.
Right. Right, exactly. Speaking of Polk and DefTech, we saw some new speakers at the show, and I wanted to make sure we spent a few minutes on those. The Definitive Technology Demand Series, we have a photo of that, I believe. Let's see, Definitive Technology, there it is.
Yep. This picture I like and sent to you because we had gotten into a discussion in the forum. Somebody was asking if it really did have a waveguide on that tweeter or not. As you can see here, there's a flare and recess that is, in fact, a waveguide, and it has a lens on it as well. And it's also offset. So some people get mad about marketing specs. Well, as far as the description of the speaker and what these features are supposed to do, it all matches up with reality. And here's another cool thing. And this is not really a dig on, well, maybe it is a dig, but, Definitive Technology in the past was not known for publishing anechoic plus minus 3 dB specifications, but these speakers carry them. So they have the traditional Definitive Technology marketing specs, but they also have real anechoic specs associated with them. And in speaking to them, that was one of their goals, was to get into that world of talking about the actual, not embellishing. So I thought they looked really good, and that they looked like solid designs with proper thinking behind them, and a quick demo show floor. I mean, what's it going to tell you? Well, they image well. And that's something you can ascertain quickly. This combination of features and aesthetics, and also the fact that it represents a new line of thinking on Definitive Technology, that prompted me to give it a Best of CDA award. And I really kind of wait to get a pair of D11s and to do a two channel, just basically enjoy them the way that I've the way that I think a good pair of bookshelves should be enjoyed, which is intimately, because what a two-way monitor can do is sound very pure and very detailed. So that's what I'm looking for from these.
There were actually three different models of this in this new line, three different sizes.
Right.
And they range from tiny to small.
So yeah, the little guy is corded. I think that's 4.5 inch D7, and then you got a 5.25 inch mid bass driver, which gets a passive radiator on the back instead, and then a 6.5 for the largest model.
They're not that expensive. I think the small ones are $4.99 a pair, right?
Right. So yeah, $4.99, $7.49, and $9.99 a pair, respectively.
Pretty good.
Is that the $9.99 that they were demonstrating in that little closed booth I had? I think it was. I'm not sure.
Large ones?
Yeah, they had a small closed booth in the back where they were doing a small demo. They sounded pretty good out there. The stuff they were showing at their open, their semi-open booths on the show floor, they all sounded horrible, but that's not the fault of the product.
Yeah, the sound room is a little bit better. At that point, I'd rather just get them as quickly as I can and check them out.
Yeah,
home,
try them
of
out.
Course, because
what are they? Right. Are they shipping now, or when will they be shipping? Do you know?
Very, very promptly, if I recall. Weeks, not months.
Not months. Well, before we leave speakers, one last thing I want to mention is the Creative X5 Sonic Carrier Soundbar.
Yeah, I got that.
Yeah.
Speaking of being out on the show floor and being impressive, Mark, tell us about that.
Okay, so I like beamforming and the way it can create audio illusions. And I think anybody can reasonably say that soundbars is where the research into that has been, you know, recently. Yamaha, I had thought of as the best at it. But Creative, let's face it, they've been in the audio processing game a long time, especially with their PC sound cars, Sound Blaster and all that. So this Sonic Carrier, people have known about it for a couple of years. There are people on the AVS that have had an order in, pre-order, for over a year. So there's an incredible amount of patience, impatience, whatever you want to call it around this, anticipation. It does look like this fall is when it ships, so fingers crossed again. So $5,800 and you're getting a soundbar and one wireless sub. Okay, and if you want to add, you can add up to three more of those wireless subs to it for $2,200 a pop. So you could end up with a $12,000 soundbar.
If you go shopping,
it is Atmos.
It is Atmos, and honestly, what it really is, I did the sound room demo. That's fine, and it's balancing the sound out the walls. It has sound speakers. It has up-firing drivers. I'm kind of used to that. You know, I've heard some good Atmos coming out of soundbars, or at least, you know, for a soundbar, I think Atmos or immersive audio is a significant improvement. This one's really big. It's really wide. It's really powerful. It's got 1,000 watts inside the actual unit. I think the subs are 600 watts a pop. But what blew me away was, when I left the sound booth, they were like, oh, did you do the outside demo? I was like, what outside demo? Well, they had one just sitting on a table outside. I think you have a photo of that. And this is the convention hall, so there's no wall. There's no ceiling. It's just their carpet, noise. I sit down, and they start playing, Eagles, Hotel California. And, boy, if it didn't just create the full stereophonic spread, holographic illusion of a big stereo in a room, just all that stuff, and without like some weird tinny artifact, and I was thinking about that. I mean, I guess it's so full of processing power and it's higher end parts. You're used to hearing beamforming through cheaper devices, but done at this level, there's not artifact. You hear a sonic hologram. So that to me was extraordinarily cool, because that hinted that here's a device that can overcome room acoustics. It's not really depending on walls. That's the problem with the Yamaha. It's bouncing stuff off a wall. This thing can just do it staring right at you. Now, at the lower end these days, you've got DTS coming out with the Virtual X. So we know that the technology is like at this threshold where virtualized 3D immersion is a frontier. This is probably the best example of it. Maybe that I've heard. So that's what I thought about that device. I mean, it was pretty darn cool. I mean, outrageously expensive and for many people weird, probably. But
Just to follow up on what Mark was saying, I saw that at E3 because they have been showing it around for a while. And there is a huge amount of processing in that thing, more than two or three DSPs.
Wow. Right, yeah. Right. And since Creative is more or less a game accessory company and PC product company, I'm not surprised that it was shown at E3, which is the gaming convention, which I avoid like the plague. But Mike, you were very brave. And
I don't value my hearing as much as you do.
Well, listen, before we get to the last bit, Mike, I wanted you to talk a little bit about Mark mentioned it at the beginning of when we were talking about audio, and that's Alexa, or more generally, voice control. That was like everywhere, wasn't it?
Yeah, and that's, connected everything is much of what CD is all about these days. But at the Geeks intersection of video and audio and control, it's interesting that there were Alexa-based products, there were Google Assistant or Google Home-based products. For the voice interface, I won't use the A word because then people will complain. But
because you'll wake up their device, yes.
A round black thing on your desk, a round white thing on my desk, do this or do that. And the trick from Cydia, and there were three of them, the one in the middle, which is the Sony LF550G, amazingly looks like what the HomePod is going to look
Apple
like.
The Apple HomePod, right.
And I saw that and I said, how'd they get a HomePod? Oh, no, wait, it's the Sony booth. But those were in many of the booths, but the most interesting thing at the intersection of audio and video is a piece that was introduced by Origin Acoustics. And for those who are into the in-wall speaker world, that's a company that was formed by Jeremy Burkhart, who was an innovator, has long been an innovator in in-wall speakers and used to own Soundcraft. Now,
Speakercraft.
Yes, I'm sorry. And at first glance, that looks like an in-wall speaker in that picture. But what it really is an in-wall speaker mount that is sized to fit an Amazon Dot. And then you put that up in the ceiling, and it's connected to your system via Cat 5 wire, which carries both the power to light it up, and then it connects to an amplifier that you can use to power the speakers. So if you want it to be inobtrusive but still provide audio through your own speakers, for all the home theater guys, I know that's off the AVS track, but a lot of the home theater magazines gave that their product of the show awards.
Mm. Okay, so yeah, basically putting that in your ceiling, making it unobtrusive, and you can just speak, and we're entering the Star Trek universe that I think Mark mentioned.
Right, just then have it integrated with your audio system. And one other interesting thing was everybody had their own version of these things. I found it very interesting that Harman, or in the Harman booth, they had JBL products that looked like their cylindrical form factor that were Google Assistant. They had a Harman Kardon. It looks like the sound sticks without the sticks, that sort of fishbowl-looking thing that they have that was Alexa. Oops, sorry. And they had a cylindrical thing with Cortana. So, you know, there's an indication of a big company looking to play all bets.
Hmm. Okay. Well, there was clearly an awful lot of stuff at this show, and anybody who said meh to Cedia this year, I dispute in the strongest possible terms. In fact, there's tons more we didn't even get to. And now we have to go to the final question, which is, what was the best video and what was the best audio that you saw and heard at the show in a demo setting, obviously? Let me start with you, Mike.
Well, I'm going to go back to what I said before, and although it's not really mainstream, I really like the video on the Barco, the video art on the Barco things. And, you know, second to that, I've got to cast another vote for the Sony projectors. Audio, to be honest, I really didn't have. I'm a video and IoT guy, and I just didn't have the time to check out the audios to give a good opinion.
Okay, very good. Mark, how about you?
Okay. Sony projectors, yes, but my favorite thing there, it wasn't quite a demo, Scott, the 100-inch Sony Z9D that Sony had out in their booth.
Mm. Oh,
that's my TV right there.
It is awfully good TV. There's no question about it. It's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, that was killer.
Yeah, how much is that? That's probably $15,000, $18,000, something like that.
No, it's much, much more. They
way
ordered
more.
Them just, yeah, it's like $50-something.
$50-something. Yeah, my mistake.
If
you have to ask, you can't afford it.
Yeah, okay, all right. Sony 9D.
Way more zones than the other ones. It's the only one you can get that has a four-figure zone count from what I've heard. Or I don't know. It's got a gazillion zones in it.
Right,
and
right.
Phil Jones also mentioned that it could do 2,500 nits for 6 hours continuously.
All right, so that's pretty good. What about audio, Mark?
Okay, so this is a little dark horse, but of all the demos, PMC Audio, I'm giving it to them. They moved air like I just was like, what is going on? The bass in that was the tightest and... To call it impactful is an understatement. So PMC Audio, which is, you know, they're like movie mastering, loudspeaker kind of monitor business. Wow.
All right. Very good. Tom?
This is getting to be a kind of a unanimous best picture of Sony, Sony projectors, especially their
Sony projectors.
Especially their new, especially their new laser projector, which I saw twice, both in their booth and in the comparison with that that shootout event that, that Mike went to later. Right. On audio, I probably missed a few of the audio demos. I was concentrating on video, but I'd have to say for impact, I'd give it to the JBL Synthesis room.
Mm, that that room did sound mighty good. I heard that demo as well. Well, okay, then I'll give you mine. For me, I love the Sony. The Sony projectors I thought looked really good. The Z9, of course, we know looks really good. I had to get, for me, I had to give Best Picture to the Wolf TXF 5000, which was in the Stark audio room. I'm sorry, no, it was in the, my mistake. It was in the Seymour Screen Excellence room. And I thought that that's basically a super souped up version of the JVC laser projector, the RS 4500, lists for $35,000. The Wolf is souped up in a big way and is around $50,000. I just really love that image tremendously. So that's what I gave that to. Best audio at the show for me, again, was the Stark sound room. That was, and it may not have had, you know, the most bass, and Mark, I understand your position about PMC, but for me, it, the cohesiveness and the seamlessness of that audio demo, which was Atmos, right? It was 7.3.4, I believe. And, there was just, it was just such a cohesive, beautiful, seamless sound field. And I kept thinking of the word liquid, because it was just, there was just something about it that was so beautiful and impactful. And even though they were at, they said they were at 1 dB, 1 decibel over reference level, which I would normally run screaming from the room at that, I did not find it objectionable at all, because it was so clean and so low in distortion that I actually didn't mind. I was happy to listen to that. It was just gorgeous. So that is my pick for best sound. I think overall the best demo I heard was the Seymour Screen Excellence with Audio Excellence and Wolf Cinema. That had the best overall package. There were a number of people who really liked the, who vote would have voted for the Alcons demo. Who else here heard that? I know Mark, you did.
I did.
And
I'm just having a hard time, but the one problem I have is just I didn't hear, couldn't hear all the audio demos either. Alec did hear Alcon, and that's that. That is a system that you just have to be very careful with, because it can hurt you.
Last year it did. Last year at Cedia, it was so loud I ran screaming from the room, and it's very bright because they have those. Those ribbon tweeters, the speakers.
Resolution is undeniable. I mean, it's it can and it has dynamic range, like, you know, I mean,
like nobody's that's what you're business.
Getting at. Yep. Yeah, totally.
Mm-hmm. Tom, you probably heard the Alcons demo, right?
No, actually, I missed it, though. I did hear it last year, and that may be why I missed it this year.
right, exactly. Well, I still give it to Stark. For me, I think they had the best sounding booth there, best sounding demo anyway.
I agree. Okay, the imaging, yeah, I agree. Yeah. I agree of the aspects that you described. Yeah, it was the best of that.
Right, PMC might have had better bass, and unfortunately I didn't get to hear the PMC demo. I wish I had. But in any event, like I said, there's so much to cover. We've covered a fair amount of it, but not all of it. Certainly, you'll want to go to avsforum.com and to soundandvision.com, where Tom, you and a bunch of people are covering, writing up coverage of the show. Mark and I are at AVS Forum. Mike, where can we find your coverage of the show?
Residentialsystems.com and hiddenwires.co.uk.
Okay. There you are. Mark Henninger, of course, at avsforum.com. Tom Norton at soundandvision.com. Thank you guys so much for being here. It's been great fun.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you, Scott.
Yeah, you bet.
So much fun.
Lots of fun. And so, as I said, you can find me and Mark both at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter, and Mark, too, at avsforum. You can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/HTG and on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twithometheatergeeks. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Jack Holm. He's the president and CTO of Tarkus Imaging and a color scientist. And he's going to be talking about high dynamic range, which there is still a lot to talk about. So I do hope you will join us for that. Should be a very geeky episode. Until then, geek out.